Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. Each year, Wyoming Public Radio's newsroom produces countless stories for this show, helping to paint a picture of the state of Wyoming each week. Today, our journalists look back into 2023's Open Spaces vault of stories and choose their favorite, and we get to hear why. From reporting on ticks,
it was so weird and quirky, it made all the other hard, tiring days of reporting last year totally worth it.
To backcountry fishing.
Had my microphone with me and was just so desperate to catch a fish, because if I didn't actually catch something, well, it wouldn't have been a very good story.
And place-based education.
And I was able to hear about the older generation's hopes for the young people of today.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we cut through the distracting clutter in the week's news and get to what really matters.
It's sweet, but can we talk about the nipple rings?
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we take the shirt off the news and see what's under there every week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 10 and Sunday afternoon at 4 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Hello, listeners. This is Megan Feary, and I am so excited to kick off 2024 with a brand new Human Nature episode. This time, a woman sets out on a cross-country trip with a borrowed dog and no plan.
That's when I was like, oh God, whoa, what did I get myself into? Maybe this isn't for me, you know, maybe I should just go home.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. For this episode, the best of 2023 Open Spaces, each reporter explains why they chose a story as their favorite from last year. We'll start with our natural resources and energy reporter, Caitlin Tan.
So although it wasn't the hardest hitting piece of reporting that I did last year, it was just so weird and interesting and honestly very fun to report on. You know, I really couldn't have asked for more with this story. You know, the focus was on a creepy, crawly arachnid that we all have to deal with, or at least our animals do. And then an extremely intriguing person that I interviewed and followed around who had great sound bites. His name is JB, and if you can believe it, his real name is James Bond. And I followed him around last spring because he gets a lot of ticks on him. And so he did this tick experiment. And honestly, it was so weird and quirky, it made all the other hard, tiring days of reporting last year totally worth it. So if you haven't listened to this story yet, all you have to know is that it includes a tick card. I hope you take a listen.
From late March to midsummer is when ticks are out. You know, those creepy little bloodsuckers? They're actually the second most dangerous creature in the world when it comes to transmitting disease, only behind mosquitoes. Well, in western Wyoming, people are saying it's a big tick year. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan looked into it in Sublette County, where there's the highest rate of tick fever disease in the country.
Walking through the grass and sagebrush is Sublette County's local horseshoer, JB. Now, his actual name is James Bond.
Oh, 007, you know, and I mean, I've been hearing that for 50 years, you know.
But he's also known by friends as someone who always gets ticks.
Like if I'm out walking around with other people, I will find a tick on me or two, and other people don't.
And this year he's had more than usual. So he's collecting ticks in his yard to get an idea of how many are out there. He does what actual researchers do, using a white bedsheet.
I just have it draped out behind me, but I'm walking backwards and just dragging it slow by these, you know, by grass.
Ticks will grab onto the sheet like they do to us. Bond checks it for ticks.
There's one over there and that one.
So here's the technique.
He picks them off with pliers.
Come on, you little devil.
And then sticks them to scotch tape wrapped around his wrist.
There's a big one.
He gets 7 in about 10 minutes, the 2 days before he got 40. It's a lot of ticks this year. Scott Shell, who's an entomologist with the University of Wyoming, has a theory as to why. It has to do with over half of some of the mule deer and pronghorn herds dying in Sublette County from the harsh winter.
There's still those ticks out there that would have normally been picked up by deer and antelope and elk as they wander around the trails. If you go out fishing and you're walking down the trail, your ideal, you know, substitute.
Teton County Weed and Pests McKenna Smith says that's a plausible theory. She says another reason could be the rainy weather.
Just having a general higher humidity could make them more active.
Smith is studying ticks in western Wyoming for the first time, mainly because there really isn't a lot of data on ticks in our area.
For public health especially, it's very important to know what factors could be impacting their survival, their population.
Smith says some of the only data she could find for the area showed that about 1 in 5 ticks carry Colorado tick fever in parts of Sublette and Teton counties. And while tick fever isn't usually deadly, it's like a really bad flu.
You know, people think of ticks, they think of the East Coast, and they think of Lyme disease. We don't have Lyme disease, but we do have ticks. They are out.
The Wyoming Department of Health says so far this year, there are no reported cases of tick fever in the state. But in the last 10 years, there were 14 cases in Sublette County, which is the highest rate in the country. And James Bond, the tick catcher, he's had tick fever. He got it in 2003 at his home. And over the years, it made him hyper aware of ticks.
So that's when I started gluing them to a card and then dating them, you know.
He calls it a tick card. The rules are the tick has to be on him in the house. Outside doesn't count.
Put the tick on. He's trying to crawl away. You put a dab of glue on there. Take a toothpick. Push him over into the little puddle of super glue. And he's still crawling away. And then you just take a little bit of baking soda, sprinkle it, and like it goes, sets up like instantly.
Last year, he had 9 ticks on his card. The year before, just 3. This year,
9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14.
And there's still at least another month of tick season. Experts say if the rain continues, it could be even longer. Now, after all this talk about ticks, maybe you're feeling a little itchy. I know I was.
God, now you have me getting the phantom itches. Isn't that funny? You start talking about them then you start feeling them.
Getting all creeped out.
Here's a hot tip from Weed and Pest. When you get home from being outside, don't throw your clothes straight into the hamper. The ticks will literally come find you. So put the clothes on high in the dryer for 10 minutes. It'll, quote, nuke them. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Pinedale.
And now our Mountain West News Bureau reporter, Will Walkie, with his favorite story from 2023.
My favorite story that I produced from this past year brought me to the Wind River Mountains, and I got to talk about a sport that I love, which is fly fishing, and learn a little bit about how, you know, human beings' love for fly fishing in the West has changed the environment, not only in the winds, but like just in alpine lakes throughout the region. When I think about why I became a reporter, one of the things that I wanted to do in my life was not be bored. I wanted to be able to talk to different people, have different adventures, and do something a little bit different every day. And like getting to do this story was just the culmination of exactly why I became a reporter and why I love being a journalist. It's one of those stories where I'm sure 5 years from now, I'm just going to think back to the time where I showed up at sunrise. You know, it's super cold, like the first frost of the year, in the winds, walked 10, 15 miles and had my microphone with me and was just so desperate to catch a fish, because if I didn't actually catch something, well, it wouldn't have been a very good story. And I ended up getting a fish, definitely the most satisfying one I've ever gotten, just a beautiful trout. And it's everything that's great about radio. It's putting together a good piece of sound. It's taking the listener on an adventure and bringing them to a scene. And there really might not be a more beautiful scene than Wyoming's Wind River Range.
Wildlife managers across the West have been stocking high alpine lakes with fish for decades, mostly so anglers have something to catch. As Wyoming Public Radio's Will Walkie reports, new research is looking into how that history changed the Rocky Mountain environment and the genetics of the fish themselves.
It's just after sunrise at the Wind River Mountain Range, and I'm quickly realizing summer's over.
There's frost on the tips of trees, lots of cars in the parking lot, and cold people.
My mission today, catch a trout deep in the wilderness. I hike about 8 miles in and reach a long, skinny blue lake above 10,000 feet. I passed maybe 5 people on the way.
Just put my rod together, and I'm gonna cast out a little bit. I'm gonna be trying a bunch of different flies today until one works.
It takes some trial and error, but finally I find a spot where I see fish. I cast out a yellow foam grasshopper.
All right, come on, baby.
Watch it float down a small current, and then...
Yes! He's got it.
I reel in an 8-inch cutthroat trout with a pronounced rainbow stripe, red around its throat, and brown spots.
That is a beautiful, beautiful fish.
It's this backcountry catch-and-release experience that got me hooked on the sport when I first moved to Wyoming, and one that enthralls a lot of Western anglers. That includes Jen Brown, a university professor who wrote a book on the history of fly fishing in the region.
We think of the West and fly fishing in the West as this very pristine activity, one that is out in the wilderness and untouched by humans, where people go find themselves out in nature. But those fisheries and those trout only exist through widespread manipulation of the environment.
She says most people aren't aware of how alpine lakes first got fish. Individuals, sporting clubs, and government officials stocked them starting in the 1800s. In the winds, there weren't any native trout before humans got there.
Let's introduce fish. It's a nice, like, backcountry survival food. They're pretty easy to catch, and it brings sport.
At the start, people would carry milk cans full of fish on their backs or on horses. Today, video shows fish and game workers filling cans with minnows from a hatchery and dumping them out of vehicles, or in some cases, helicopters. States in our region stock tens of millions of fish into rivers and lakes this way every year. And that manipulation has created some interesting consequences.
If you look at them under the microscope, you see all kinds of little structures.
Katie Wagner is showing me jars full of fish at her lab at the University of Wyoming.
It's a little messy, so it's good as audio.
She was part of a research team that looked into how lakes and the winds have changed since humans introduced fish there. It's an extreme environment where water is iced over for more than half of the year, so it's hard for species to survive.
And how is it that that's feeding back onto the fish themselves? How is that impacting their own resource and their survival in these environments?
What the team found was a case of rapid evolution in just a few decades. The changes are most obvious when looking at gill rakers. That's the trout's filter for small prey. The more they have, the easier it is to eat.
What we found is that in populations that were stocked 50 or 100 years ago, we have more gill rakers than in populations that were stocked recently or that we look at from the hatchery.
Wagner says this is significant because most people think evolution takes thousands or millions of years.
The idea of putting fish into these really extreme and novel environments and watching them change over the course of a human lifetime is an exciting finding.
Researchers say there's a hopeful angle too, that no matter how much humans change our environment, life will maybe be able to find a way to survive, even in extreme circumstances. And that's something anyone that visits the woods can appreciate. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Will Walkie in the Wind River Range.
Stay with us. Up next, we hear about grizzly bears and the sheep industry. This is Open Spaces.
This time on the Modern West, Ariel's family and neighbors start rebuilding after the Marshall Fire destroys their homes. But new green building codes are making it super expensive.
You're just propping up the people who can afford this, and it's really elitist. You know, it's saying if you can't afford any of this, you're not going to live here.
A desirable neighborhood. It's part four of our series, The Burn Scar. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by the Argosy Foundation.
Hey there, this is Kelly Trujillo. Join me Saturday mornings for Buffalo Grass, 11 to 1, on listener-supported Wyoming Public Radio. You'll hear the best in bluegrass music, old and new, plus Americana, folk, Western, and even a little bit of Celtic. That's Buffalo Grass, Saturdays at 11 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to the best of 2023 Open Spaces. In 2023, I learned about how grizzly bears are expanding their range and potentially connecting with new ecosystems. That was my favorite story in 2023. That's because I started reporting on grizzly bears almost right away when I first started here in 2017. I'll admit, I knew almost nothing about the bear before then, but as I covered the constant debate of whether the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem grizzly bear should be listed under the Endangered Species Act or not, I met so many people who were passionate about this because of their personal experiences. This story was one that I wanted to report on for a while because of the idea of different grizzly populations connecting kept on getting hinted at in different conversations. Instead of reporting on what humans thought, this was covering how grizzlies are expanding out of their range and humans needing to react. Plus, I was able to go out in the field and meet people in person, talk to them for a while, and try to get a better understanding of how they feel about grizzlies expanding. And that's my favorite part of reporting. Grizzlies are listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, but some experts and landowners think one population in and around Yellowstone National Park should be considered recovered. Meanwhile, some environmentalists say in order for the grizzly population to be fully recovered, it needs more genetic diversity. One way to do that is by allowing grizzlies from a central Montana ecosystem to travel south and breed with bears in the Yellowstone ecosystem. The technical name for that is creating connectivity, but that 100 miles or so between the two ecosystems is populated with over 200,000 people. I visited two communities preparing for grizzlies. Last year, junior high school students in Alberton, Montana, had their school day interrupted for something unusual.
We did have one bear shot in Alberton last year, and it was right within sight of the school, and that really had an impact on the students.
That's Bob Summerfield. He heads up the Brovald Community Orchard in Alberton. He says last year there wasn't much natural food, so it was an especially bad year for bears in a community of about 400.
And so the fruit that we did have, the bears had to access it by climbing in the trees and getting the fruit. And so in the process, they broke a lot of limbs out of the trees and caused a lot of damage. So that was kind of the impetus.
Alberton decided they wanted to become a bear smart community. That means eliminating things in town that lure bears to wander in. And they started with the community orchard.
This is our brand new fence. And so far it's been 100% effective in keeping the bears out.
The community installed an electric fence in mid-August. That was in preparation for when black bears come into town, but also for when grizzlies arrive.
But grizzly bear populations are continuing to expand. And they will be here. It's not a matter of if they will be here, it's when they will be in town.
And when that happens, Summerfield says it will be a whole new ballgame. Alberton sits on the edge of the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem. It's prime grizzly habitat, but as more animals are populating the area, younger males are wandering further out looking for new territory.
We're already kind of getting into habitats that are less suitable for grizzly bears simply because there's more human activity on the landscape.
That's Frank Van Manen. He's a leader in grizzly bear research. He and other scientists have tracked grizzlies straying further away from protected habitats like Yellowstone.
You know, whether it's small towns, agriculture, human developments, roads, those are all factors that contribute to making areas less suitable for grizzly bears and creating a higher risk of mortality.
Basically, human-made attractants like garbage and fruit trees lure the bears into town. If the animal ends up relying on those food sources, they stay in populated areas for longer, and there's a higher chance for the bear to get killed, whether that's by accident or as a safety decision by wildlife officials. So these areas are less fit for animals to live in. Lori Roberts with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department says that's okay. These areas are meant to be connective zones, areas where bears can pass through to more livable ecosystems.
We're not looking to have bears in these connectivity zones be at crazy like population levels. We're not going to have 500 bears, but we do need those so that we can have natural, you know, connectivity and genetic movement between these ecosystems.
The two ecosystems are about 100 miles apart from each other, and over 200,000 people live between them. Robert says some towns in this region know that they are in this pathway and have started asking themselves questions.
Do you have any wildlife corridors that move through your community that would bring bears down there at certain times of years? And what does that look like? Going through your community and assessing what would be potential bear conflict areas.
Missoula, Montana, just 30 minutes east of Alberton, was one of those communities that asked themselves those questions. They realized the community of about 78,000 people has a lot of potential bear conflict areas.
So Greeno Park is a park that has a creek that runs through it.
That's Erin Edge. She's part of the Missoula Bear Smart program.
Bears frequent this park. It's also heavily frequented by people that live here, using it for just kind of hanging out by the creek, up to running, to walking, just to enjoying the outdoors.
Like Alberton's Bear Smart program, it's modeled after a program in British Columbia. The way it works is a community creates a working group that develops a step-by-step protocol of how to make a community bear-proof, says Chris Servine. He's another member of the working group there.
If we could solve the fruit trees, the bird feeders, the pet food, and the garbage, we'd have most of the issues solved.
So they created a conflict management plan based on those major attractants. That plan got the community involved through regulation, education, and awareness.
So we've got the city and the county unanimously now in favor of providing these regulations so that all the cans will be bear-resistant cans in the next 3 years. That's number one. That's 49% of the problem.
Meaning 49% of the bear conflicts in Missoula are from the animal getting into the garbage can. And the town did it. Recently, both the Missoula City and County passed regulations requiring garbage cans to be bear-resistant in the next 3 years. And they'll continue to work on decreasing those human attractants until the day the grizzlies start passing through. The key word there, keep those grizzlies passing through and not lingering in the area, munching on garbage or fruit.
The goal is to not go to the house that you can see from where we're standing right now and tip over their garbage and eat garbage and then decide, oh, you know what, that garbage is way easier, way tastier for me to get into than choke cherries.
It turns out, to get that genetic diversity that some say the Yellowstone population needs to get off the ESA, it could only take one or two grizzly bears. Here's grizzly bear scientist Frank Van Manen.
It would only take one or two animals that come into the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, would breed with a Yellowstone bear, and then introduce genetic material from the Northern Continental Divide.
Van Manen stresses, the Yellowstone bears are fine in the short term. The genetic diversity is really important decades or hundreds of years from now. But even so, it could happen quicker than we expect.
It might have already happened, and we just haven't documented it yet because our genetic analysis, you know, take a little bit of time to be completed.
Van Manen says these bear smart communities are key to making the connective route more accessible for the grizzlies. And that could be the final key to the Yellowstone grizzly bears getting removed from the endangered species list. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska. Here's our Roundup reporter, Ivy Engel's preferred story.
I wasn't able to do a lot of reporting in 2023, but this is by far one of my favorite stories that I've gotten to write. Wyoming has a large sheep industry and a long history of raising the animals. I've gotten to know some people in the industry over the past few years, so when they told me they were putting their first celebration of the industry together, I knew I had to go. When I got there, I met a group of people whose passions for their animals and their livelihoods shone bright and fierce. I tried lamb for the first time, and I got to hop into a truck and help move sheep camps with a local rancher. Despite some technical issues with my recorder, I'm proud of how this piece turned out, and I look forward to using the knowledge I learned at the festival to better report on the industry more in the future.
At the beginning of the month, ranchers converged on Kemmer for a celebration. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel reports from the first Wyoming Sheep and Wool Festival.
On a recent warm summer morning, Trudy Julian is hooking up a tiny camper trailer to her truck. It's parked at the base of the mountains in a hilly, grassy area. Last night, sheep herders stayed here overnight with their sheep. They woke up early in the morning and have already started moving the sheep on horseback along the land. They're working their way up the mountains to the Bridger-Teton National Forest. Julian is moving this trailer, which is called a sheep camp, to the next overnight location. It's basically a tiny camper trailer with just enough space for two people to sleep, a cook stove, and a couple of cabinets. Sheep herders live in these year-round.
Well, I mean, this is what most sheep that run on the range, this is how they do it. They trail everywhere they go because, I mean, there's usually too many to truck. I mean, it would take so long and so much work and so much money if we had to truck them from Kemmer to the forest and then from the forest back to Kemmer. And then in the winter, we go out by Rock Springs.
Julian has been a sheep rancher all her life and is the fourth generation to work the land outside of Kemmer. Wyoming's sheep and wool industries are some of the largest in the nation, and they've been around since the state started. And really, not much has changed in the industry since then. Trudy's daughter, Marie McLaren, brought one of these sheep camps to the first annual Wyoming Sheep and Wool Festival in Kemmer.
I think people see the sheep camps out on the range as like a thing of the past that isn't around anymore. And so I just want to like show people that it is still around and we're still out there on the range doing the same thing we were hundreds of years ago.
The camps have solar power and are pulled by a truck now, but they're fundamentally the same. Another thing that's hardly changed, the camaraderie felt between those working in the industry.
I mean, that's the thing that attracted me to the sheep industry is it was a huge family and they welcome you with open arms if you're willing to listen and be a part of it.
That's Allison Crane, the executive director of the Wyoming Wool Growers Association. It was one of the main organizations putting on the festival. Crane says it was an opportunity to show the public this historic way of life.
I know there's been some moments already where people have had some learning experiences here, and there's been some good but hard conversations had and some hard questions answered for people.
An example of that was the difference between how ranchers use and perceive the skulls and horns of their animals and how many in the public may think about those same skulls. That was exactly the kind of thing the organizers were hoping for. The 2.5-day event was open to the general public as well as the sheep producers. For Crane, the first night when they served lamb hors d'oeuvres during the programming showed how the industry embraces the community.
The pinnacle of last night was, you know, having a bunch of people stand around those lamb roasters and just get to like be a part of the family.
The rest of the weekend included educational talks and demonstrations, a panel with multi-generational ranchers, and a vendor fair in the heart of downtown Kemmer, where you could buy products made from wool, learn about sheepdogs, and even pet a lamb. The University of Wyoming Wool Program was also there, teaching people about how wool is judged and sorted.
Our finest on the table that we have here, and it goes all the way down to our coarsest fleece, which is a 44, and it's pretty rugged feeling.
The festival was also meant to celebrate the ranchers and give them a minute to visit with other producers and let their hair down, especially after the tough winter. The extreme cold and amount of snow meant they lost a lot of animals. Even the younger participants agreed that something like this was important.
I'm Sarah Brooks. I work for Trudy. In the summer, I dock.
Docking is shortening the lambs' tails to avoid diseases and pests. Brooks is just 11 years old and is glad there's an event like this happening.
To let people know how hard we work and how hard the ranchers work around here to bring meat on the table.
Overall, people were excited about gathering, reminiscing on the past, planning for the future, and sharing their passion and livelihoods with the public. The festival is planned to take place again in Thermopolis next year at around the same time. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Engel.
Up next, our tribal reporter revisits a beloved story about an Indigenous youth camp. This is Open Spaces.
Hi, it's Daryl Brogdon here with the Underground Martini Bunker, home of the Retro Cocktail Hour. I hope you'll join us every week for classic tiki tunes, TV crime, jazz, swinging soundtracks, and more. You're the designated driver on the highway of cool at the Retro Cocktail Hour. Saturday night at 6 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Wyoming Public Radio takes you around Wyoming. Listen for interesting stories from down the long streets and around the state. Around Wyoming, weekday mornings at 6:06 and 8:06, and afternoons at 1:30 and 4:48. If you have a Wyoming story of interest, you can send it to me at iengel@uwyo.edu. Thanks.
Welcome back to the best of 2023 Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Hannah Haberman is our rural and tribal reporter. Here, she's explaining what she loved about a story on an Indigenous youth camp.
One of my favorite stories for Open Spaces this year was about an event on the Wind River Reservation. It brought students from Wyoming Indian High School out for a day of learning on the Eastern Shoshone Bison Pasture. The all-day gathering was held outside, in a big open field up above the river, on an early sunny fall day that felt like summer. Its goal was to help connect young people to land, elders, and professionals in the environmental world. It was such a vibrant coming together of different people of a wide range of ages, all in the name of education. In between interviews, I hunted for crickets in the tall grass with the young daughter of one of the people helping out with the event. And I was able to hear about the older generation's hopes for the young people of today. I got to listen as young people asked questions, learned from others, and just enjoyed being exactly where they were. While producing the story, I loved having the opportunity to get to convey the feeling of the event through sound. Bison burgers sizzling on a grill, drumming and singing, and the hum of people coming together to carry on some of the things that matter the most to them.
Students from the Wyoming Indian High School in Ithidi spent a day learning outside on the Wind River Reservation. The event was a partnership between the Hobbs School of Environment and Natural Resources, Greater Yellowstone Coalition, and the Wind River Tribal Buffalo Initiative. And it was the first of its kind. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman finds out what happened and what might come next.
On a bright Wednesday morning, 40 or so sleepy-eyed high school students sit at plastic folding tables. They've got journals and pens in front of them, but they're not in your typical classroom. Instead, they're in an open field of sagebrush that's currently home to the Eastern Shoshone bison herd.
We want you to prepare yourselves in a good way for the future.
Wes Martell is an Eastern Shoshone conservationist who works with the Greater Yellowstone Coalition. He's trying to get the teens hyped up for the day.
Well, how do you want to figure out your life? What do you want to do in your life to take care of yourself and your family and be part of your community and be part of your tribe?
Some of the high schoolers are still waking up, but the sun and the surrounding landscape seem to be doing the trick.
Pretty lucky to be from Wind River. We have 2.5 million acres of land. We're the same size as Yellowstone National Park. And we have everything that Yellowstone National Park has except Old Faithful.
The day is part of a larger 3-day event that also brought 5th and 8th grade Wyoming Indian School students to the Shoshone Bison Pasture. The project came about thanks to a grant from the Western Water Assessment. Its goals? To help young people connect with elders and to support cultural empowerment, environmental stewardship, climate action, and tribal governance on the Wind River Reservation.
Six.
Shaded booths are set up in a rough circle across the green and gold pasture. At each station are regional experts in the fields of biology, hydrology, and conservation, and tribal members with lessons on language and climate change. The high schoolers rotate between the 9 different booths throughout the day.
What are some things you guys noticed?
The smell.
The smell, yeah, so it has a really strong smell. Did anyone else notice the smell?
Yeah.
At one station, they discuss sagebrush conservation and how the plant might be managed in an ever-changing climate.
Do you think the government should play a really, really big role and have a lot of restrictions? Or on the other end of the spectrum, do you think it should be a free-for-all? I want to hear your opinions. Free-for-all? What about, is anyone in the middle?
At another station, the students make chimichurri from green onion, cilantro, garlic, and shallots, then put it on reservation-sourced bison burgers sizzling fresh off the grill.
So we can take modern recipes and incorporate some of the things that we can get out here to make them better.
Jana Black is a graduate student at the University of Wyoming. She helped organize the event.
It's been really wonderful to see like the facilitators being so engaged with the students and having like these lesson plans and then going with the flow and how the students are asking questions.
Black is Alaskan Athabascan on her mom's side of the family. She says a big hope of the event is to help the students feel more connected with their community and more spiritually grounded on the land.
In this age, I feel like we are becoming a little more disconnected from the land. I feel like a lot of this camp, too, is about sense of place and building that connection to the land.
Eugene Ridgely Jr. is teaching about some of the different uses of bison at one of the stations. Food, clothing, shelter, guidance. He works at the Northern Arapaho Tribal Historic Preservation Office. He says he hopes the event can inspire young people to keep staying connected with their culture.
It'll start a spark in someone to continue doing what we're doing. And even making a career with the National Park Service, you know, finding positions there. And coming back and helping and sharing our knowledge with our people.
Ridgely's presentation made an impression on at least one high school senior. Wes Martell's granddaughter.
My name is Kalia. I'm a senior, and my favorite station was when they were passing around and telling us about the uses of buffalo. There's like a lot of ways that you can use them for.
For her grandfather, that connection is the whole point of events like this.
That's all we're trying to do, is strengthen our families and our communities, and our young people are an important part of that, an important place to start.
This first iteration of the event was a success, so the organizers are working to find more grant funding to make sure it can continue in the future. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Don't go anywhere. Next, we hear from 2 more Wyoming Public Media reporters. This is Open Spaces.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back?
It does, on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
Neuroscientist Wendy Suzuki basically lived at her lab.
I just felt really, really bad.
So she started working out, which improved more than just her muscles.
My focus was working better, and that made me say, what's going on here?
Wendy's discovery has kept her active ever since. New ideas to help you keep your resolutions. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to the best of 2023 Open Spaces. I'm Camila Kadelska. Jordan Uplinger is our Northeast reporter. He explains the reasoning behind his story choice.
The feature itself, like in a technical sense, could have been better. It was my first feature, so a lot of editing came down to the last minute. But the process of interviewing five different people, all with their own unique understanding and opinions on this multi-billion dollar project, overcoming vast untouched landscapes to add down like lines and towers that make up the basis of modern communication for us. It's a very interesting story where the frontier kind of meets the future, and I feel like I could have done a 9-hour feature on it, and I wanted to give everybody more time to talk and share their opinions, but I should probably just kind of focus on like getting my editing done in a timely manner first. Looking back, though, I hope that this story will be a mile marker for me.
The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act was passed back in 2021, and it's been expanding broadband internet access across Wyoming. But is it possible, in the vast, untamed lands of Wyoming, to bring internet connection to every single rural resident? Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger tries to find out.
Okay, I'm off now. Can we go check out the ute?
Oh, yeah, do you mind?
Sure.
Cool.
In the Woods Landing area, a few miles southwest of Laramie, Mike Gray takes me out to meet his wife, Christine Gray.
Kind of funny.
Yeah.
So Zoom got goofed up.
Oh, really?
And so that's why I had to go over, and I'm like, he's coming out to talk about that.
Christine just finished up a telehealth meeting with one of her clients. She's a psychologist, and Mike relies on the internet as well as a graphic designer. Full disclosure, Mike is an employee of Wyoming Public Media, although you're more likely to find them working in their yurt or their home office instead.
This internet typically is very stable, but at the yurt sometimes it's not quite as stable because it's further away, from the main router.
For, a use of our internet.
Their little compound, as Mike calls it, is extremely rural, but that means the internet infrastructure is super rural as well. Getting reliable internet is critical for both of their jobs. One day, Mike looked up at the sky.
We were in Saratoga in the hot tub, and all of a sudden, 80 satellites go over, and we're like, in a row, what is that? And we thought it was a nuclear strike or something. And then somebody there was like, no, that's Starlink. And I'm like, what is Starlink?
Like having your own personal radio tower, Starlink connects you to a system of low Earth satellites via a tiny square dish device. For some, Starlink has been one of the few options for receiving any kind of reasonable internet speeds outside of our few cities. Christine says everyone uses internet now, including rural communities.
It's almost like human right public health issue is kind of how I think of it, because like kids with school, people with work, like this is something that you need to have in this day and age.
This is the same argument the federal government is making, and it's why the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act was passed. To give states money to bring all of their residents online with high-speed internet, primarily through fiber cables. But not everyone agrees on the best way to carry that out in a state like Wyoming.
So I think right now what we're aiming for is to start with just a basic level of service where people can communicate, people can pay bills, people can shop, people can do business as they see fit.
Thomas Laycock is the AARP's Associate Director of Communications and Advocacy for Wyoming. He believes a powerful, high-speed fiber optic network will improve the economic health and experiences for all Wyoming residents. Laycock says to take care of all Wyomingites fairly and equally, investments have to be made.
It is a big spend. There's a philosophical debate that's being waged along those lines because, as you mentioned, there's a lot of mountains to go over. There's a lot of space to cover. There's a lot of things like that. And you have a number of folks that will say, you know what, that's kind of the cost of doing business in Wyoming. Is you learn to live
in some of these open spaces that unfortunately don't have access to services. And so is that something that we want to spend money on state and federally? And for some people, the answer is no. For most of my members that we've talked to, the answer is yes.
Not everyone thinks the flashy price tag for fiber is worth it, like Brett Glass.
I think that's a mistake. We should spend the money where there's demand, not where we're subsidizing something that people don't want or need.
Glass created Lariat, a wireless broadband company which he says was the first of its kind in 1992. He prefers practicality over power, saying that there's more efficient ways to provide internet access to those who want it. But he's not a fan of how the feds focus on fiber for everyone everywhere.
Well, everybody needs broadband sometimes. The question is your cell phone adequate? Or do you need a very high-speed connection to where you live? And, again, only an individual can tell that. This is one of the reasons why our programs should be pull rather than push. People should be able to ask.
The cost for fiber optic broadband installation can be $1 million a mile sometimes. An 11-mile project to get internet to residents in Oriva Hills near Gillette is projected to cost $3 million. But then, that community would be connected with high speeds, and eventually the high cost of upkeep. The Biden administration wants to subsidize that cost through a program called BEAD. That's the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program. And Ms. Zempel, who runs the Wyoming Broadband Office at the Wyoming Business Council, knows the program well. She says BEAD mandates that they need a plan for 100% of people in Wyoming to get internet access. And in addition, they'll give the state $348 million to do so. But it'll cost a lot more than that.
There's not enough money to build it out with fiber. So we're going to look at passings that are expensive. Broadband speeds, we're going to aim for that. But how else can we provide internet? And so there's a place for satellites still now, or fixed wireless. But that's still, there's costs associated with fixed wireless when you're talking about building towers and upgrading electronics and different things like that. And you can't get around the hill.
And that's what it comes down to. Everyone will need some form of connection that can get around the many hills and mountains that make Wyoming such a unique case for federal investments of this magnitude. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jordan Uplinger.
And as the 2024 Wyoming legislative session inches closer, our general assignment reporter Jeff Victor chose a story from 2023's session as his favorite. Here is why.
As the Wyoming legislature debated bills that would ban trans girls from high school sports or outlaw gender-affirming care, it was clear to me that a lot of people didn't really know what they were talking about and weren't familiar with the lived realities of LGBTQ youth. So I looked at how these bills would affect queer youth generally, and I asked young gay and non-binary people in Wyoming what they were thinking about the attempts to limit their freedoms.
Another bill working its way through the Wyoming legislature would forbid teachers from covering certain topics in kindergarten to third grade classes. The bill is touted by its supporters as a necessary check to keep classroom conversations age appropriate, but opponents fear it will stigmatize queer youth. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor reports this bill is just one of several anti-LGBTQ plus pieces of legislation on the table this session.
The bill forbids teachers from giving instruction on sexual orientation or gender identity, and it requires schools, broadly, to report any changes in a child's mental, emotional, or physical health. In a recent Senate education meeting, lawmakers debated the bill for an hour and a half. Opponents said it leaves teachers confused about what they can or cannot say in the classroom, and that it discriminates against queer youth. But Senator Beau Biteman took issue with that description of the bill.
Where in this bill, specifically, does it say we're going to discriminate against anybody in the state of Wyoming?
The Wyoming Education Association's Tate Mullen answered Biteman directly, saying the bill turns a child's identity into a talking point. Mullen pointed to research showing that this leads to worse mental health outcomes for the children at the heart of the debate.
We know in the state of Wyoming that we have an incredibly high suicide rate in our youth. We know that our LGBTQ plus students are disproportionately at risk for depression and suicide attempts because of the stigmatization that is out there. This bill addresses their identity and does exactly those things.
Where and how does it, you've lost me on the curve there.
Committee Chair Senator Charles Scott, like Biteman, didn't see the discrimination Mullen was talking about. Supporters of the bill reiterated that the bill is just about making classroom discussions age-appropriate. While these adults largely talked past each other, some testimony stood out louder than the rest. Specifically, testimony from one of the people who would have been directly impacted by the legislation. Ash Silcott, a teenager from Laramie County, argued against the bill. Silcott told the committee they personally had a supportive home life.
But sometimes kids in our school district don't get that. They don't get support at home that I was so lucky to receive. I have almost lost so many friends to suicide because they come to school and say, my parents don't love me. My parents won't love me if I come out to them. I can't say anything.
In a later interview, Silcott said when children in homes like that discover they're gay or trans or non-binary, a school teacher can be the trusted adult they're lacking at home. But the so-called Don't Say Gay bill would take that safe place away and force that teacher to out the child before they're ready. Because the bill is ambiguously worded, coming out as gay or trans could be considered a change in the child's mental health and require the school to notify their parents. Silcott says that would rob queer children of a crucial lifeline.
We're trying to find our place in our world, and if we're figuring that out and we're told where we found ourselves is wrong and we don't deserve it and that we don't deserve the things our peers get, we're going to be dejected. We're going to feel hurt. We're going to feel like our lives don't matter.
And that feeling feeds into the astronomical depression and suicide rates experienced by trans youth. Research shows that suicide rates are higher in areas where trans youth are not accepted, where people don't call them by their preferred name, or where laws limit what they can talk about in school or what health care they can access. The Don't Say Gay bill is just one of many pieces of legislation this session that impacts queer youth. Another bill would criminalize most trans youth health care and punish anyone providing it with up to 10 years in prison. So gay and trans teenagers are watching the legislature closely this year. But they're not the only young people watching. At the University of Wyoming, the queer community is on edge.
There was always a background radiation of homophobia.
That's Tanner Ewalt, who serves on ASUW, the Student Senate.
We're at the school where Matthew Shepard was murdered. That image is always bouncing around in people's minds. Then everything happened and the climate got significantly more scary for a week.
The week in question was in December, when a string of anti-queer harassments and disruptions became the talk of campus. It was just weeks after a gunman shot up a gay club in Colorado Springs, and it made UW students apprehensive about the upcoming session. Ewalt, just like Silcott, just like most young queer people in the West, have lost friends to homophobia and transphobia. Ewalt fears what this new legislation means for the next generation.
I have friends that aren't here today because of the climate that existed in their household regarding homophobia and queer issues. And they voluntarily came out to their parents. Forcing students to come out to parents is going to kill them. And for the ones it doesn't kill, it's going to make them want to get out of this state immediately.
For their part, Ash Silcott thinks most lawmakers want to do what's best for Wyoming. They're just ignorant about the real issues.
This is affecting real kids. We just want to be the people we want to be, and we want to feel love and acceptance. And we want to feel like we belong in this community, which is what every kid deserves, to feel like they belong.
The so-called Don't Say Gay bill has passed in the Senate and is now awaiting introduction in the House. For Wyoming Public Radio, this is Jeff Victor.
And that's a wrap. We hope you enjoyed this special episode of our Best Of from 2023. We'll be back next week with a whole new show. Thanks for listening. The entire show and all the stories you hear can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Melody Edwards, our producer, and Ivy Engel, our digital producer and social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.